The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Nathaniel Philbrick, the New York Times bestseller of the Mayflower and the Heart of the Sea, is here with his brand new book and soft cover, Bunker Hill. Nathaniel, welcome.
It's great to be back.
All right. Kind of an author that loves to get back into history, and now we're right in the 1776 era with your brand new book, Bunker Hill. You know, a lot of people you're going to recognize in your book, eh?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are names we all associate with the Revolution in Boston. It's John Adams, John Hancock, and Samuel Adams. And they're in the book. But what's, I think, a surprise to many people is that the real focus is on someone that most people haven't heard of, Joseph Warren. The three that I just mentioned were a huge part of the Revolution, obviously, but they tended to be away from Boston at the Continental Congress in Philadelphia when the things were happening. And so it was a whole different cast of characters that actually made the on-the-ground revolution happen. And so it was, for me, a fun book in that it took on a whole different cast of characters from what I was taught to think of Boston and the Revolution.
Nathaniel, when I was reading Bunker Hill, I was surprised. Now, I've never been to Boston myself, but Boston's a peninsula?
Yeah. Well, Boston today bears absolutely no resemblance to Boston in 1776. Back then, it was an island, a 1.1 square mile island, 15,000 people living on it, dominated by three hills of mountainous proportion. I mean, really big hills. And if you've been to Boston, there's still Beacon Hill, but that is just a shadow of what it once was. And it was this island connected by a thin neck of land to the town of Roxbury. Since those times, they have used those hills to expand the island until it's now just a part of the mainland. And so the Back Bay in Boston is now a neighborhood. Back then, it was the Back Bay. Water actually lapped on Boston Common, and that was from where the British regulars departed in boats on their way to Concord. And so a lot of my research process was trying to get a handle on what was Boston like when it was an entirely different place in the Revolutionary War era.
How long would it take them to knock the hills down and create solid land from an island to the mainland?
Yeah, it was a process that took over 50 years. It was gradual, and they began, the Back Bay was never very deep. It was kind of mucky, and at low tide was pretty much tidal flats. But gradually, they expanded it as the population of Boston expanded. And so, you know, my wife and I have an apartment in the south end of Boston, which actually would have been in the mud flats right next to the neck of land where the Gallows was, just outside town. And there's a bar called The Gallows. And you know, so you get these very sort of subtle reminders of what it was once like.
In your book, Bunker Hill, I found it a little funny because Boston at the time, I mean, they had killings.
Yeah.
Of course, we don't have the tar and feathering anymore.
Right. But, you know, we have a tendency to think of our revolution as nonviolent, you know, the exception to the rule, that we gained independence through eloquent speeches at the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. But no, as I try to show in this book, this was a revolution like all revolutions. When you bring down a regime, violence is inevitably involved. And in the first chapter of Bunker Hill, I describe this horrible tar and feathering of a loyalist named John Malcolm. And it was the coldest night of the winter of 1774, just a month and a half after the Boston Tea Party. And they pull him out of his house, rip off his clothes, take him to the center of town, and pour hot tar on his body, smear that hot tar with feathers, and then drag him around town and beat him up for the entire night, finally dump him at his house, and he spends 6 weeks in bed with the flesh literally being pulled off his body in heaps. And so, you know, this kind of thing happened. The passions were high, and people were willing to take the law into their own hands to make change. And so, you know, I think people will find a different kind of revolution in this book compared to what many of us grew up with thinking it was like.
I think he found a fondness for burning flesh and tar, didn't he?
Well, John Malcolm, I mean, that's the thing. This was a time when there were 15,000 people in Boston. It was all very personal. It wasn't necessarily all ideology. It was who you knew, who you didn't like. If you didn't like someone, you were going to be on the other political party. And John Malcolm was someone who just relished a fight. And so he brought it on himself. And when he went through this horrible ordeal, he survives, God knows how, and he's proud of what has happened to him. And in fact, he keeps a bit of the flesh from his back. He preserves it in a little sort of trophy case, and he gets on a boat back to England and appears before the king and presents him with this, you know, here I am. And he wants to be crowned a knight of the tar because he likes the smell of it, he says. And so, you know, these are personalities, you know, that defy any kind of prediction. And that's the combustible nature of revolutions. These are people that you can't pin a label on necessarily, that things are going to go in unexpected directions.
It seems like the one, and there's somebody that is in charge of the tar and feathering, which I thought was kind of weird.
Yeah. Well, you know, we think of these things as just wild, chaotic mobs. And there were actually people that no one was in absolute control, but someone like Samuel Adams, for example. And he really, if there was one person who was responsible for making all of this happen, it was Samuel Adams. He really had a vision of that America should be independent, and did everything he could to work things in that direction. But when it came to tar and feathering, there were a couple of ways to do it. The really mean way was to take off their clothes and just pour it directly on. And it was actually John Malcolm on a previous encounter had been tarred and feathered when he was working for the crown in what is now Maine, with the customs service. And he was, his belligerent act, you know, he was just a jerk basically. And he got the crew so angry at them that they tarred and feathered him in the civilized fashion, which meant his clothes were still on, but they tarred and feathered. So he wasn't, you know, as hurt as he would have been physically, but it was obviously a warning that did not have much effect on Malcolm's literally combustible personality.
Bunker Hill, of course, this about the book titled Bunker Hill, that was a great battle, probably about the first battle of 1776?
Yeah, it was really the first battlefield battle encounter of the revolution. Lexington and Concord had occurred 90 days before, but those were really skirmishes, and it wasn't a question of two armies meeting on a field. Bunker Hill was different. It was a clash of two armies, and it would be the bloodiest battle of the entire 8 years of the revolution. I mean, it occurred under extraordinary circumstances. The town of Boston is on this peninsula, as we talked about earlier, and on only a quarter mile across from the tip of that peninsula is the peninsula of Charlestown. And at the end of that is a hill known as Breed's Hill. And this is a confusing battle from beginning to end. The Battle of Bunker Hill was actually fought on a different hill, Breed's Hill. The Americans, the night of June 17, built a earthen fort, a redoubt, on Breed's Hill. And they dug in. And when the British saw that they had done this, they knew that a cannon in this fort could fire not only into Boston, but at all the naval vessels that were throughout Boston Harbor. So they decided they had to attack. And they had close to 7,000 soldiers in Boston. Boston, by this point, was a city of occupation, British occupation. The revolutionaries were now all outside of Boston. And so they crowded into the Charlestown Peninsula and not only occupied the fort, but dug in along the width of the Charlestown Peninsula as 2,000 British regulars were rowed across to Charlestown. Meanwhile, all the residents of Boston are on the roofs of their houses watching. People throughout the town surrounding Boston and Charlestown are on the hills watching. The book begins with 7-year-old John Quincy Adams watching with his 31-year-old mother, Abigail. as the battle unleashes, and they're watching 2,000 British regulars marching towards these provincial soldiers who are dug in. You know, and everyone assumed that when faced with the awesome spectacle of the British army, they would run panicking. But they didn't. They held their fire till they saw the whites of the enemy's eyes, until the soldiers were just about 30 yards away, and fired, let her go. And it was a devastating volley. It would take three charges before the British would finally take the hill. And this is another thing. Most of us think of Bunker Hill as a great American victory. No, technically the Americans lost, the British won, but at a terrible cost. The casualties of close to 50%, which is just amazing. Half the soldiers either wounded or killed. And as General Howe, who led the fighting, said, it was a British victory, but it was too costly.
How unusual is that for group that lost the most in battle to take over possession of what they were fighting for?
Yeah, well, you know, this is the nature of, if you can get in the high ground and occupy yourself, you can inflict terrible casualties on a much larger force if they're willing to take them. And, you know, and that's how they accomplished what is really a miraculous battle. When you look at how disorganized the Americans were, how new to this they all were, that they were able to inflict these casualties and then retreat and surrender the land to the British, which really did them no good. You know, so this kind of thing happens. During the French and Indian War, a decade and a half earlier, there had been a similar situation right around Fort Ticonderoga, which had then been occupied by the French, and the British experienced devastating casualties. And so this kind of thing happens, and it's, you can gain the victory, but do you win the war? And, you know, and ultimately it would be the Americans who would win the war.
With the Revolutionary War, what kind of new innovations were there to help the new Americans beat the British?
Yeah, well, one of the innovations was the rifle, you know, which was something that the backwoodsmen in the Western territories became famous for. And a rifle was a new modern technology. It was took longer to load and fire, but because it had this long bored barrel, you could aim with much greater accuracy and at much larger distances. And so this was used to good effect by the Americans. There weren't many rifles at the Battle of Bunker Hill, but as the Continental Army was formed in the months after the Battle of Bunker Hill, these riflemen would appear, you know, would change the nature of the fighting. And in fact, but one of the things that the Americans did at the Battle of Bunker Hill was to aim for the officers. The officers' coats were scarlet as opposed to sort of a washed out red. And by aiming at the officers, you know, they really did terrible things to the morale of the army. And at one point, General Howe, who led his army, he was up there surrounded by his family of officers. By the second charge, everyone surrounding him, every officer around him, was either killed or wounded. And he was seen by both British and Americans standing alone, almost at the edge of the American line. Somehow, he was not killed. He returned to the bottom of the hill, regrouped his men, and they finally took the hill on the third and last charge. And so this was a man of immense personal courage. You can quibble with the strategy that they, you know, why that there were ways to go at this where they didn't necessarily have to endure these terrible losses. But this was part of a learning process for the British. Some arrogance was involved in it, but you know, this was just the beginning of what would be an 8-year-long war.
This is about a city, a siege, and a revolution. Am I correct in thinking that the British played a gentleman's war where they would stand and fire, where the new, well, what would become New America, they would hide and shoot them that way? Is that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair, you know, it's a little bit of a simplification, but it's essentially true. And this drove the British crazy. They were geared up to fight traditional battles on a battlefield. And during Lexington and Concord on April 19th, 1775, 3 months before the Battle of Bunker Hill, the British soldiers had made it to Concord after engaging the Lexington militiamen and then militiamen in Concord, they then had to get back to Boston, more than 20 miles away. And they were besieged by militiamen who would used the stone walls, the trees to great effect, and fired on these soldiers as they made their way back. And it became a very desperate struggle where they were fighting house to house on their way back. And they were hugely resentful and angry at, you know, what was happening to them. But it was, you know, this is the beginning of a revolutionary partisan struggle. And it's not pretty. It doesn't follow those traditional gentlemanly laws of battle. And it was, you know, just a harbinger of things to come.
Boston, they really didn't like to pay the taxes to England. Do you see maybe a mirror image of what might be happening today that happened back then?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's very easy to cherry pick from the past and, you know, and find incidents to support your own point of view. And the fact of the matter, it was a very different time. People had different, their sense of liberty was different from ours. We think of personal freedoms, you know, that it's my right to do what I want. They didn't see it in those terms. It was more of a collective right for people to own property and to, you know, to function in the way, social, cultural ways that they had. And when it came to the taxation issue, you know, we've all heard that it was a case of representation and all that, and the Boston Tea Party is famous, where most of us think of it as the British imposed this huge tax on tea, forcing us to pay it. Well, the reality was that the British had all of this tea in the East India Company in London that they wanted to get rid of. So they decided to lower the price of tea by a third, making it cheaper for the colonial consumer. They included a small, infinitesimal tax, but they saw this as, hey, we're making this tea cheaper. But this was an issue for the patriots. And adding to this was that many of the patriots were merchants who were smuggling illegal Dutch tea that they could sell for less money than the English tea used to have been. Once the tea was lowered, now the smugglers were out of luck. And so that contributed to their ideological indignation. And so, you know, it's more complex. But, you know, Americans, many of them were descended from Puritans who had come to New England to escape the influence of the British bishops, you know, the British king. And they were used to going their own way. And they saw the British attempts to make the Americans pay for their upkeep. Because, and that's really, the English didn't see this as tyranny. They just said, hey, this is fiscal responsibility. And so you just had two very different points of view. And it didn't help matters that there were 3,000 miles of ocean between both parties. And so, you know, communication is such a big part of this story.
Boston, of course, you know, the English people had it made in Boston because they had the Navy. They could be supplied. Mm-hmm. The citizens of Boston really had to get most of their stuff from England, didn't they?
Once violence broke out at Lexington and Concord and then Bunker Hill, and Boston became a city under siege, where the British and the remaining citizens in Boston were literally surrounded by the Patriot militiamen. And so they no longer had access to the farms and fresh vegetables and meat and things, but they did have the British Navy, which, as you said, was able to provide them with goods from England. But these were things like hardtack and salt pork, but they didn't have the foods that they really wanted. So they were suffering because of the siege, and so it was a real standoff. After the Battle of Bunker Hill, George Washington would arrive and oversee the siege, and finally forcing the British to leave. But it was very grim, and it was the real beginning of people realizing this is not just a group of skirmishes and battles. This could very well be a war.
Let's talk about a couple other books here that you have. New York Times bestseller, Mayflower.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I talked to you about that a long time ago. I might be wrong on that, but tell me a little bit about that book.
Yeah, well, Mayflower was really where I got the idea that I wanted to write Bunker Hill. Mayflower is about, as the name would suggest, begins with that famous voyage with the settlement of Plymouth Colony by the people we refer to as the Pilgrims. And it seemed to me that the more I researched it, I realized that I think most of our information is based on what we learned in third grade at a Thanksgiving pageant where, 102 pilgrims sailed over on the Mayflower, jumped onto Plymouth Rock, were welcomed by the native peoples, and a year later celebrated that first Thanksgiving. And that's the story. And there's, like all legends, there's an element of truth to that. There was the first Thanksgiving. And what's interesting about that is it was a profoundly native event. The Wampanoags outnumbered the English 2-1. But what in that book I realized, that's one part of the story. What was interesting to me is how quickly that the possibilities of that amazing scene were thrown away with the next generation, with a war known as King Philip's War, fought 55 years later after the voyage of the Mayflower in 1675-76, precisely 100 years before the American Revolution, in which this is a terrible, we think of the Civil War as the bloodiest war in America. Actually, when it came to the per capita people killed, King Philip's War was much bloodier than the Civil War. It was just horrible, and it forever destroyed, almost came close to obliterating the native presence in New England, around in Plymouth Colony, and it forever changed things and really created the template by which America would move west with the Indian Wars of the 18th and 19th centuries. And so that's where that's the arc that book describes. And it was in writing about King Philip's War that I realized how much of what is involved in that war would inform 100 years later the outbreak of violence in the American Revolution in New England.
I guess the Mayflower wasn't really like a Queen Elizabeth or anything like that. It wasn't a huge ship.
No, it was not. If you go to Plymouth Plantation in Plymouth, where it's a replica is there, and it's tiny. And you go down below decks, it was known as the tween decks, where 102 pilgrims lived. And you go, how could this happen? The amazing thing, however, is they made a modification in this replica. There's 8 feet of headroom in that, so that people like us, when we're down there, don't hit our heads. Actually, there was less than 5 feet of headroom. So, it was like a crawl space. It was a story where you begin to realize, it was different back then. And these were truly pioneers, but with religiously informed pioneers that would create a legacy that would define so much of what would become America.
There you go. Well, the book Mayflower, of course, more than just pilgrims, a rock, Indians, and a turkey. Bunker Hill, you were just talking about the Civil War.
Yeah.
And that was basically brother against brother, families against family. Would you consider Bunker Hill the same type of battle?
Yeah. In many ways, the Revolution was a civil war. I think a lot of us grew up thinking it was good patriots versus bad British. It was light versus dark. And the fact of the matter is it was much more complex than that. You had brother fighting brother. Most people didn't want a revolution. They were happy the way it was. And in fact, it was estimated that the average American paid 1/50th of the taxes that paid in England. These were the least taxed, freest people on earth. And the British were saying, what are you complaining about here? And so both sides had legitimate concerns, and it divided families, and it ruined lives. It turned everything upside down. And one of the, I end Bunker Hill. I begin it with John Quincy Adams as seven-year-old watching it. I end it with him in his 70s, watching in 1843 the celebration of the building of the Bunker Hill Monument that now stands there. It looks like a small version of the Washington Monument in D.C., and he refuses to attend because he was a president, a one-term president. He is now serving as a lowly congressman in the U.S. Senate, in the U.S. Congress, and he has decided that the most important issue is slavery. That if we don't face it, this was one thing that those revolutionaries did not deal with. They, it was a revolution in the name of liberty, with a serious flaw. And so for John Quincy Adams, the revolution was not over. The revolution would lead to the Civil War. And I think it's important to realize that the Founding Fathers did not finish it. They started it. And it led to a great society, but still had a lot of issues to work out, which would result in, you know, the terrible destruction of the Civil War.
Brand new book, Bunker Hill, Nathaniel Philbrick. How about a website if I wanted more information about this, The Mayflower, The Heart of the Sea, and other books?
Yeah, it's nathanielphilbrick.com, and there you can... you know, all my books are, you can see reviews and covers, and often I do have done interviews surrounding them, and you can see those texts. And I also have a blog and you can Facebook and all Twitter and all that kind of thing. So, you can also email me through that. And I really enjoy getting those emails from readers. And if you have specific questions, I'll try to answer them.
All right. The brand new book is Bunker Hill by Nathaniel Philbrick. A city, a siege, a revolution. With this book, now what I found kind of amazing was all the people gathered in Boston, and some of the people in the book that you've heard of that signed the Declaration of Independence, older than I really thought, some younger. And some great pictures in here and a great story. Nathaniel, thanks a lot.
Hey, it's been a pleasure.
Been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, with Nathaniel Philbrick, author of his brand new book, Bunker Hill. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.